Hello, good evening, and welcome. Thank you for coming tonight to hear Maxine Kaufman-Lacosta and Dr. Sharat Lin. Tonight we're very lucky to have both these people speak, and we will begin the evening with Maxine Kaufman-Lacosta, who will probably be correcting the pronunciation of her name, and talking to you about her experiences as a dual citizen of Israel and Canada. Maxine is from San Francisco originally. She has traveled extensively, and she will tell you about her work as a nonviolent activist to end the occupation during the 7 years she spent in Jerusalem, as well as other points. And her book, Refusing to Be Enemies, is based largely upon interviews with her fellow activists, Israeli, Palestinian, and internationals working to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Please join me in greeting Maxine. Thank you.
Thank you. Doesn't usually work too well. Am I speaking loud enough for people to hear? Because if I have a microphone, I tend to turn my head a lot, and it's going to be on and off.
I'm trying to record the night, so if you wouldn't mind just using
it. I'll try, but as I say, because I turn my head around, you'll get more even sound if I'm not using a mic. But we'll see how it goes. Okay, now that's supposed to stay put, right? Hopefully. Okay. So, yeah, okay, I'll correct the pronunciation of my name. She saw me made of make a face.
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Maxine Kaufman-Lacosta, and it's a Ukrainian name, and I'm not, the last part is a Ukrainian name, and I'm not going to explain any more unless somebody asks me later, because it takes a long time. And I'm trying to set my timer here. Shoot. Okay. And I don't know, Marlene, do you think you can give me a 10-minute heads up?
10 minutes?
Like 10 minutes from the end, like after 35 minutes. Sort of. So anyway, the introduction wasn't exactly what's going to happen. What I'm doing on this trip is speaking more about the book rather than my own experiences. And the book, as was said, is based on interviews with over 100, mainly Palestinian and Israeli nonviolent activists. And a few internationals, and I'm going to need more light than I've got. Is it possible to have a little bit of light here? So
yes.
Thank you. But in 1959 and 60, I was an idealistic teenager participating in a Zionist youth workshop on an Israeli kibbutz. At that time, the Palestinians who had been displaced by the creation of the State of Israel were, to me, simply refugees, unfortunate victims of war for whom the neighboring countries would hopefully provide a refuge. But 20 years later, in 1979, I had my first opportunity to spend time with Palestinians on their own turf. Thank you. That's great. When I attended a 3-week Quaker-sponsored program in Ramallah in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, there I began to develop an understanding for Palestinians' attachment to the land, and to realize that one way or another, we, Jews and Palestinians, would have to work out a way to live together in this land that we both loved and both saw as our homeland. I made a couple of further visits to Israel and Palestine in the mid-80s, and from December of 1988 through mid-October of 1995, I lived and worked in Jerusalem for much of that time as Hebrew to English translator at the Jerusalem Office of the Alternative Information Center, or AIC, a joint Israeli-Palestinian venture, while participating in a variety of solidarity and joint activism, including a small nonviolence training collective. And while I was at the AIC, I also compiled a little pamphlet called Creative Resistance. It was an interview-based booklet of anecdotes of nonviolent activism by activists in Israeli and mixed groups. I had hoped to find, at that time, a Palestinian who would put together a similar volume of Palestinian activism. I wasn't successful, probably because they had a lot on their plate at the time and just didn't have the time and energy. But what I wanted to do is I was seeing a lot of nonviolent activism, but people weren't calling it that. And I had hoped to communicate to these groups that although they weren't calling what they were doing nonviolence, there was a worldwide movement that did call these kinds of actions that, and that they could connect up with this worldwide movement and obtain both useful resources and opportunities for mutual learning. And also that there were historical precedents for successful nonviolent campaigns. So when I put together the pamphlet, I included some background on nonviolence, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and so on, and some resource materials such as Gene Sharp's famous 198 Nonviolent Tactics, and an outline for a short nonviolence training. This was 1993-94, and at that time, as I said, I looked for a Palestinian partner for this project and wasn't able to find one. But when the Al-Aqsa Intifada broke out in October of 2000, and I'd been back in Canada for 5 years, I began thinking what I could do in the new situation and thought, I'm getting a bit old to go lie down in front of bulldozers. Maybe it's time for another book. I mean, a real one. So I made a visit in December of 2000, and during that time I met both Israelis and Palestinians who were not only engaged in nonviolent activism, they were beginning to call it that, and they were beginning to reach out to the wide worldwide nonviolent movement. So I decided that attitudes towards nonviolence having changed on the part of both Israelis and Palestinians, the time had come for another book of interviews. But this time, describing both Palestinian and Israeli nonviolent activism in a single volume, and this time with a Palestinian partner from the beginning. So I made my first trip in connection with this book in the fall of 2003. Hassan Andoni of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement and the International Solidarity Movement had agreed to work with me on this project. And I began my 6 week stay by interviewing many of the Palestinians that Hassan and his colleagues at the PCR had introduced me to, on the theory that if I ran afoul of the Israeli authorities and got banned from the West Bank, I'd have some Palestinian interviews under my belt and I could continue with the Israeli ones at my leisure. Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions joined the project about a week into that first trip. And both Hassan and Jeff have provided invaluable editorial input throughout, as well as interview and written contributions to the book. So today, I'd like to give a brief introduction to Refusing to Be Enemies and to a small sampling of the interviewees and organizations that made the book possible, some of the nonviolent strategies that have been effective, and a look at where nonviolent activism in Palestinian and Israel is now. Now, I don't do much history here or in the book, but I would like to briefly call attention to a couple of points to place the present nonviolent struggle in context. This slide and the map cards that you picked up at the door illustrate the near disappearance of Palestinian land base in historic Palestine in the years between 1946 and the present. And I'd especially like to call attention to the first two panels that show the dramatic difference between the relative proportion of land held by Palestinians, the green, 93% at the time, and Jews, mainly the Jewish National Fund, 7%, the white, in 1946, and the amounts offered by the UN partition plan in November of 47 for the formation of Arab and Jewish states, 45% and 55% respectively. To those who expressed surprise that although the Zionists who would have liked more were satisfied to start with what they were allotted, but the Palestinians were not at all pleased, I point out that it's a little bit like if someone came and took over your backyard and then offered you half back. It's not surprising that they weren't pleased. The rest I'll leave you to read on the cards. This slide here gives an idea of the vast number of Israeli Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank. And for a more up-to-date map, you can see peacenow.org. It's on your list. And this slide shows the root of the barrier that Israel refers to officially as a security barrier. Semi-officially, and by a lot of other people, it's called the separation wall or in Hebrew, Gedor HaHafrada, which can also be translated as an apartheid wall. And what's particularly notable on this particular slide is the degree to which the wall, the root of the wall, deviates from the green line, or the armistice line separating Israel from the West Bank, effectively annexing the fields of many farmers living in the villages and towns along its route and placing them on the Israeli side of the wall, while the farmers themselves are on the other side with great and can only receive permits to cross the wall with great difficulty. I also want to make it clear that nothing that I'll say tonight or that I say in the book is meant to imply that nonviolence is new to Palestinians or something brought to them by Israelis or internationals. In fact, Palestinians have implied nonviolent means in their resistance to colonization at least as far back as 1902, including a 6-month general strike during the 30s and a multitude of nonviolent actions since 1967. Notably during the First Intifada, when an estimated 85 to 95% of the actions called for by the unified leadership of the Intifada in the leaflets they handed out were for nonviolent actions, strikes, marches, and the like. And Mazen Kumsia wrote a book a couple of years, or just published last year, and I believe you have copies for sale in the back there, entitled Popular Resistance in Palestine. And he does a lot, he gives you a lot of history, and he has examples of nonviolent resistance activities among Palestinians going back even into the late 19th and early 20th century. So I'm not suggesting to Palestinians what they should do, what methods they should use, that's not my place. But what I'm doing is describing what many of them have been doing for a long time, alone and in cooperation with Israeli organizations or individuals. And the difference today being in attitudes toward and scale of this nonviolent activism, and the degree to which joint struggle of Palestinians accompanied by Israelis or internationals is becoming a part of the picture. So once I'd done the first several interviews in the West Bank, I realized that this book was not going to be about Israelis do this and Palestinians do that, and sometimes they do them together. But first and foremost, it was going to have to be about the vast scope and variety of Palestinian nonviolent activism, and with Israelis and sometimes internationals as supporting cast. And that's what the focus of the book became. By the way, the reason there were pictures of two covers on the first slide was that the hardcover version and some unofficial paperbacks that were made on that with the same contents had the first cover, and this is the cover of the current edition, the paperback. So the book begins with a foreword by Ursula Franklin, a Canadian Quaker thinker and writer, pacifist, feminist, scientist, on the nature of nonviolence, which she defines as resourcefulness as opposed to the resourcelessness of resorting to violence. The middle 9 chapters are based primarily on excerpts from interviews and conference presentations by, as I had mentioned, over 100 Palestinian and Israeli nonviolent activists, as well as a handful of internationals, and focus especially on the advantages and challenges of what's often referred to as joint struggle, that is Palestinian-led nonviolent activism aimed at ending the occupation with the participation of Israelis and or internationals. The interview-based section of the book is followed by 4 analytic essays by Hassan Andoni and Jeff Halper, my Palestinian and Israeli editorial partners respectively, Jonathan Kutab, a pacifist Palestinian lawyer who's a cousin of Mubarak Awad, and Starhawk. Now, those of you who know Starhawk probably know her more as what my husband refers to as a Wiccan superstar. But in another aspect of her multifaceted life, she's a nice Jewish girl from the States who's in solidarity with the Palestinian cause, and in fact is barred from entering Israel as a result of her, or the aftermath of her 4 stints as a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement. The interview This part of the book then is followed by my conclusions and epilogue, an afterword for the paperback edition, works cited and useful websites, and so on. Now, a number of my interviewees from various backgrounds were lifelong proponents of nonviolence, or at least unequivocally opposed to violence. Veronica Cohen, for instance, has been active since before the beginning of the First Intifada, at least as far back as the mid-80s. And I last saw her and her husband in Sheikh Jarrah at a demonstration about 3 weeks ago. She's still active. What's special about Veronica is that she's a modern Orthodox Jew, and she and other members of her synagogue, Kehilat Yedidya, in West Jerusalem, have been very, very supportive of the Palestinian cause, going back particularly to the Beit Sahur tax strike and the First Intifada. Yet they are, from that segment of the Jewish Israeli population, most often associated with militant settlers. Nuri al-Ogbi is a Bedouin, a Palestinian citizen of Israel. His tribe was expelled from land on the outskirts of the village of Al-Arqib in 1951. The army said they needed the land for 6 months for maneuvers. Well, when this 6 months stretched to nearly 60 years, a couple of years ago, Nuri decided to bear nonviolent witness by moving back to his family's land with his camper and a makeshift tent. He's been arrested multiple times and was tried, and the trial, transcripts can be accessed in English online, make very interesting reading. But a very important thing about Nuri is that he is totally for nonviolence. He believes that every drop of blood spilt is a sad waste, and that human beings are forbidden to use violence, no matter what is done to him. In this picture, you can't see it, but he has a broken wrist as a result of a rough arrest. Jean Zaru is a Palestinian Quaker, author of the recent book Occupied with Nonviolence. I love the pun. It's an account of what it's like to be a Palestinian under occupation, a woman in a male-dominated society, a Quaker and a Christian. In her case, not all Quakers are Jews. And the influence of her faith, it always takes a while for that one to get through. When I spoke at the Catholic Worker in New York City, there was in attendance a conservative friend from, this Quaker from Ohio, who was sojourning in New York City, and he caught it immediately and said, "This one's not." And the influence of her faith on her rejection of violence and support for resistance. As she says, resistance is legitimate, nonviolent resistance is even better. Amos Gvirtz is a rarity. A pacifist kibbutznik, raised on Kibbutz Shva'im, he would have received the most thoroughgoing Zionist education one could get. Yet when he became the age for going to the army, he decided that wasn't for him. And he also managed to arrange an alternative service opportunity for himself, even though neither alternative service nor conscientious objection is recognized in Israeli law for men. One Israeli conscientious objector woman said to me, "Maybe the army thinks men don't have consciences." Amos remains an activist all these years later, and not only an activist, but a thinker and theorist of nonviolence. He's written much about the subject, and his essay, A Call for an Escalation of Nonviolence, can be accessed at the website of the Palestine-Israel Journal, and the website is on your list. See why I made everybody get a list? Some of my interviewees, however, were former supporters or even practitioners of armed struggle. I don't have a picture of Ali Jeddah. I haven't actually seen him since 1998, but I happened to run into his cousin Mahmoud, shown here in the foreground, when I was with a group visiting the Old City of Jerusalem in the fall of 2007. And so I begged him for Ali's cell phone number. I'd been looking for Ali for 4 years. I really wanted to interview him. And the reason is that he had been in Israeli prison after setting a bomb. I should backtrack a bit. Ali had been a high school student in 67 when the occupation began. And he was planning to become a lawyer. And then with the occupation and consequent financial difficulties for his family, he had to quit school and go to work. But he said what most especially distressed him was the humiliating way that Israeli soldiers and settlers treated people in East Jerusalem. He became swept up in what he described as the circle of violence of the time, got involved in militant politics, and placed a bomb in Jaffa Street, which injured 9 Israelis. He spent the next 13 years in prison, during which time he had a change of heart, which I read about, I'd heard about, and this was the reason I'd been trying to locate him since beginning to work on the book. I've read an interview in which Ali had described his conversion to nonviolence, and I wanted to hear it from myself. So what he told me was that while he was in prison, he'd come to the conclusion that his main allies in, quote, the struggle against the occupation should be the Israelis themselves, the sector of Israeli society who are totally against occupation and who are looking forward to a secular democratic state in which both of us can live together in real peace and equality, unquote. Upon his release, he began working with such people at the jointly run Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem, where he worked for 5 years. And that's where I met him when I began working at the AIC as well. He also became a father, and I think that that must have also influenced his feelings about the future. He saw his children, the Palestinian children and Israeli children, as being psychologically destroyed by the occupation, and that he felt that the Israelis and Palestinians were both victims of the occupation more than of each other. He and his cousin Mahmoud, both former prisoners, now give alternative political tours of Jerusalem's old city. Yonatan Shapira is another former fighter. Oh my God, I'm just looking at the time. I have to talk faster. He's the son of an officer in the Israeli Air Force, in which he too proudly served, and he became disillusioned, especially in the wake of the Hisulim, or targeted killings of Hamas leaders, often involving the bombing of civilian neighborhoods, with the resulting large numbers of civilian deaths and woundings. Yonatan and a few others formed the core of the group of 27 Israeli Air Force officers, some of quite high rank, who signed the so-called pilot's letter to the Minister of Defense in September of 2003, denouncing these actions as war crimes. They were dismissed from the Air Force the following month. Yonatan and his older brother then decided to find like-minded Palestinian ex-fighters and together went on to found Combatants for Peace, one of the few fully joint organizations I've encountered. Netta Golan, on the other hand, got involved in nonviolent activism through family connections. In late 2000, in the early days of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, she was living in Nablus, an Israeli Jew engaged to a Palestinian she'd met through dialogue activities. From her future brother-in-law, she was hearing eyewitness accounts of how farmers in the nearby village of Hares, where he worked, were being hounded by settlers from the surrounding settlements. Some were being shot at. They were being kept from harvesting their crops. Their olive trees were being uprooted. Water lines cut, roads blocked by both settlers and soldiers. And Netta told me that she thought that as an Israeli, she could effectively confront both the settlers and soldiers. So she went down to Hares, and there she found supportive allies among the villagers. I had heard about and very much admired what Netta was doing, and I'd arranged to visit her in Hares when I went there in December of 2000. And while I was there, she told me how frustrating it was trying to get enough other Israelis to come and join her in various actions in the village, and that because of that, she and some other folks, including local activists and Luisa Morgantini of the European Parliament, were cooking up an idea for what she referred to as an international solidarity movement. Well, I thought it was a total pipe dream. Fortunately, I kept my mouth shut, but I thought, you know, people aren't coming from a couple of hours away. How would people come from halfway around the world? Well, you probably all know that a few months later it was up and running and that many thousands of activists from all over the world have participated in the ISM and continue to. Okay, so we've heard why some individuals chose nonviolent resistance to the occupation. Reasons for choosing nonviolence by organizations or for the movement as a whole fell into two general categories. Dr. Ayad Sarraj of the Gaza Community Mental Health Project, whom I didn't interview in person, I haven't been to Gaza since 1995, had an almost Gandhian approach. He says that he believes killing one person on either side is like killing all human beings, and that the only way forward is through nonviolent means. But more prevalent, I would say, was the more pragmatic approach expressed by Huwaida Araf of the International Solidarity Movement and now chairperson of the Free Gaza Movement that's taking all the boats to break the siege. She quotes the late Faisal Husseini saying that if you're going to fight Mike Tyson, you're not going to do it in the boxing ring. Or as Jonathan Kutab has said, we can't outviolence the Israelis, so why not try nonviolence? Although most joint nonviolent activism in Palestine takes place in the context of cooperation between uninational groups, either through formal coalitions or informal arrangements between Palestinian and Israeli groups, the Action Committee for the Jahalin Tribe, like Combatants for Peace and the Alternative Information Center, were among the very few truly joint ventures. The ACJT was active for a couple of years in the immediate aftermath of the Oslo Accords and organized demonstrations and a protective presence in an effort to stave off the displacement of families living beside the expanding settlement of Ma'al Adumim, just to the east of Jerusalem. We were successful in buying them time. They were ultimately moved in February of 1997, but by that time, they built a good relationship with particularly the group Rabbis for Human Rights, who hired them a very effective lawyer, Shlomo Lecker, who got them that very rare and valuable commodity, building permits, so that unlike most Palestinians in the West Bank, the Jahalin were able to build homes without fearing that they would be demolished. Unfortunately, not all the joint activities of Palestinians and Israelis following the signing of the Oslo Accords in the fall of 1993 were as constructive as the ACJT or the other joint initiatives I've mentioned, and most dialogue did not lead to dedicated anti-occupation activism like that of Netta Golan. Often, dialogue and other people-to-people initiatives, not to mention the negotiations of the peace process, were conducted in a sort of vacuum, as if the oppression of the occupation was not ongoing. This is a phenomenon you've probably heard of referred to as normalization. So when the Al-Aqsa Intifada broke out in October of 2000, and most of the erstwhile Israeli partners didn't immediately express their support and understanding, PINGO, the umbrella body of the Palestinian non-governmental organizations, demanded a ban on most joint activities, particularly targeting the people-to-people type. But an important point that's often forgotten is that this prohibition specifically does not and did not apply to cooperation with solidarity projects of Israeli human rights organizations or with Israeli institutions that support Palestinian rights. But what this meant was that some activities stopped and others continued. But if Israelis were going to join Palestinians now, it could no longer be just for a cup of tea and some dialogue. As Huwaida Araf stated, the issue has got to be the occupation. And despite the, new forms of cooperation also evolved, but also always with the condition that the focus be on the ending the occupation and that Palestinians would decide whether Israeli groups were to be invited. So what has been effective? One strategy that was often cited as successful by activists I interviewed was participation by Israelis and or internationals in Palestinian-led nonviolent actions and campaigns. This is particularly dramatic in the villages along the route of the wall, such as Bilayn, for instance, where joint weekly nonviolent demonstrations have been held since March of 2005. And the presence of Israelis or internationals has been seen to diminish both violence against Palestinian activists and feelings of isolation of Palestinians in general, humanize Israelis and internationals for Palestinians, and vice versa, facilitate some semblance of normal life for Palestinians. Oops. Oh, yeah, sorry. For instance, enabling farmers to harvest crops unmolested, and effectively get the word out in a world where Most people hear too little about what's actually going on in Palestine and often don't know what to believe of what they do hear. A practice that PCR and ISM co-founder Vasan Andoni refers to as placing the kid from Boston in Balata. In other words, a hometown person goes over, sees what's going on, comes back and reports what he or she has seen, and this gives an awful lot more credibility and immediacy to the issues than anything you might read on the internet or see on television or radio, or even alternative media. A number of successful strategies, ranging from dramatic use of civil disobedience to campaigns challenging the militarism of Israeli society, have been employed by Israeli women's organizations, notably the 10 that make up the Coalition of Women for Peace. Now, Women in Black, you're all familiar with. I don't know how many of you recognize who these three ladies are. Correct, yeah. It's not an official constituent group of the coalition, but the individuals do belong. And Aliyah Strauss over here is very active in the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And at a conference in the States, she saw and heard the Raging Grannies. And when I first encountered them at a demonstration in Berlin, January 1st, 2006, as the grannies do, they were singing mostly satirical songs in Hebrew, because that was the language that they spoke. But one of their songs was in English, and you may recognize this refrain. There is no wall in Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. There is no wall in Jericho. And then they'd give a list of all the places where there was a wall. And then they'd finish, there is no wall in Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. There is no wall in Jericho. Not yet. And Mahzom Watch is another constituent group of the coalition. I'm happy to say that this particular, particularly bad checkpoint is no longer standing between Huwara, the village of Huwara, and the city of Nablus. And I saw at least one other particularly bad checkpoint that is no longer functioning, sort of checkpoint between Ramallah and Bir Zeit. I heard that there are several others that are down, and that's really good to hear, because particularly the checkpoints within Palestine, between Palestinians and other Palestinians, were really nothing more than a means of harassment, and it's good for people not to have to deal with them. Checkpoint Watch or Mahzom Watch, the members use the fact that they're both female and Jewish Israeli citizens, but not just that. They're also mainly middle-aged or older Jewish women who look a lot like the mothers and grandmothers of the soldiers. This gives them a bit of leverage when they're trying to intervene to stop human rights abuses and so on. They also document what they see and publicize it to the media, to legislators, and to the world at large. And they spend long hours, sometimes in very unpleasant conditions. These pictures were taken on a very cold, rainy January afternoon. I was so glad I had someplace else I had to be, so I had an excuse to leave. They were there for another 2 hours after I was gone. And they do this week in and week out. Despite my earlier disclaimer, some imported approaches to nonviolence have enhanced local initiatives and sometimes the creativity and audacity of actions, and have contributed to their success and sometimes their successful media coverage. For instance, here Netha Golan is leading a role play in a Western style nonviolence training in Berlin, and over this is not cooperating. On your left, the folks in Berlin in one of their regular Friday demonstrations painted themselves blue and quoted from the Avatar movie. In a class of its own is military refusal, an important form of nonviolent non-cooperation. Small numbers of outright refuseniks notwithstanding, Peretz Kidron from Yesh Gvul, the oldest Israeli organization of soldiers who refuse to serve in the occupied territories, states that for every open refusenik, there are 10 or 20 gray refusers, that is, people who avoid service without confronting the authorities outright. And he describes refusal as, quote, the most effective way of campaigning against the occupation since, quote, there's no occupation without an army of occupation, and there's no army of occupation without soldiers. A particularly courageous form of military refusal is that of this... Sorry? Oh, my God, you're kidding. No. Okay, well, I have three extra on mine. Is that of the so-called Shministim. These are small groups of high school seniors who have each year, at least as far back as 1980, written letters to the Minister of Defense stating that they would not serve in the military as long as the occupation continued. And Matan Kamener, I interviewed when he was being held in open detention on an army base prior to sentencing. He was not wearing a uniform, which stimulated questions and, as he says, makes people think about the occupation and perhaps question their own military service. And apparently this was the case, since when his group was finally sentenced to another year in addition to time already served, they were transferred to civilian prisons as they were seen as a bad influence on the soldiers. Elek Elchanan and Wael Salameh are both ex-fighters and members of Combatants for Peace, and they bring, in Elchanan's words, war criminals and terrorists to speak to high school and college students and ordinary people in both communities. They say, we made the change to nonviolence. Anyone can make that change. Elchanan says this approach is highly effective. Quote, no one would listen to nice guys for peace. Okay, this one I'm going to quickly jump through. But the picture of important trends in the Palestinian nonviolent movement, particularly as painted over the last 2 years, the 2 years between my first two interview trips, was generally hopeful. And especially by late 2005, a trend towards increased acceptance and growing understanding within Palestinian society of the term nonviolence was evident, with many now acknowledging nonviolence, quote, as an active tool to resist and end the occupation, and no longer as a, quote, way for Israel and the West to pacify the Palestinian people. That's a quote from Hussam Jubran, who is a Palestinian nonviolence trainer who does not use Gandhi and Martin Luther King as examples in his trainings. He says, I use the first intifada. That's what people identify with. And my Palestinian editorial partner, Hassan Andoni, challenged the international peace and justice movements to increase their support for specifically activism-oriented organizations such as PCR and the ISM, which employ a strategy of what he calls offensive nonviolent engagement, with nonviolent direct action as its core. And some key conclusions based on the research for this book are as follows, that in the case of Palestinian-led joint struggle against the occupation, solidarity is not enough. That although fully joint organizations are few, many Palestinian and Israeli activist groups work together, and that it is important for Israeli participants in joint organizations or actions to avoid normalization. That is, they must not allow a sense of good relations despite the continuing occupation to blunt their resolve to maintain ending the occupation as their primary goal. And two more that apply equally to internationals is the need for sensitivity to the inherent imbalance of power in the relationship with Palestinians. You must understand their supporting and subsidiary roles. The Palestinians are in the leadership. And also, the Israeli and international participants must not allow promised satisfaction of their own agendas to compromise the interests of their Palestinian partners. Work inside Israel is also an important part of joint struggle and can take a variety of forms. My favorite here is non-cooperation with the institutions of the occupation from within Israel, and we'll get to that, I hope. But a major form of non-cooperation that internationals as well as Israelis can participate in is support for the Palestinian civil society call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the Israeli occupation. And I will just refer you again to the sheets that you have. There are the websites of the two major BDS organizations. And also, there is whoprofits.org that is set up by the Israeli Women's Coalition for Peace that lists companies and institutions, both Israeli and international, that either benefit from or contribute to the occupation. Now, Though military refusal is currently the major form of non-cooperation by Israelis, I see that there is much room for expansion. Oops. Recognizing that the number of Israelis willing to actually join in Palestinian nonviolent resistance actions in Bilin or elsewhere is limited, and acknowledging the importance of Israelis working for the transformation of their own society from within, to extirpate the militaristic and racist roots of the occupation, as do members of groups such as Ta'ayush, Zohrot, and New Profile, for example, I'm left with the question of what additional steps Israelis can take, including on their own side of the border, that will contribute significantly to the strengthening of the joint struggle against the occupation. And what comes to mind is an increase in acts of non-cooperation. Nonviolent theorist Gene Sharp, in his well-known list of 198 nonviolent tactics, describes fully 103 forms of non-cooperation. And in From Dictatorship to Democracy, a Conceptual Framework for Liberation, Sharp's more recent practical guide to the use of nonviolence, which includes this list in its appendix, this book has been translated into some 25 languages and is available for free download from the website of the Einstein Institution, aeinstein.org. I understand that this was distributed in Tunisia and Egypt this spring in the Arabic translation. It's been used in many, many places around the world, and it stresses the withdrawal of consent of the occupied or the oppressed is a very key thing in the getting rid of an oppressive regime. So what if Israelis in all walks of life were to follow the example of the military refuseniks by refusing to cooperate with other discriminatory policies of the occupation? I leave that question, but go on to quick finishing up here. 6 minutes? Well, I'm going to do 8 minutes worth in 6 minutes then. Where are we today? When I did a few interviews in January of 2010 for the afterword to the official paperback, I focused on these three key aspects of nonviolent struggle as it applies to Palestine: BDS, on-the-ground joint struggle, and non-cooperation from inside Israel. In January, BDS was already making great strides. The state of joint struggle was mixed, but broader non-cooperation by Israelis with oppressive policies, the other thing I asked about, seemed to be going nowhere. By August, though, when I sat down to actually compile my findings and write the afterword, there were increased signs of hopes in all three areas. What particularly excited me about the progress of BDS was that in August 27th last year, 53 Israeli actors, writers, and directors declared their refusal to perform at a new cultural center soon to be opened in the settlement city of Ariel. And shortly after that, over 150 Israeli academics declared that they would no longer work or lecture in Jewish settlements in the West Bank. On the nonviolent joint struggle front, a new area has opened as of January 2010 and continuing now in very good shape. There has been an ongoing weekly campaign of demonstrations and other support activities in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. And this is attracting a lot more mainstream Israelis and Israelis who don't feel comfortable going to demonstrate side by side in a place like Bilin or others along the wall. It's comfortable, it's easy to get to, it's part of Jerusalem after all. And the issue is very clear. Some Israeli settlers have taken over houses that they say were owned by Jews before 1948, and in fact some of them actually have title deeds proving this. However, nobody has suggested that the many houses in West Jerusalem that were owned by Palestinians prior to 1948 be returned to them. So the issue of the inequity is very, very clear, and a lot of people feel more comfortable at these demonstrations. And this seems to be spreading. It's not only growing in Sheikh Jarrah, but when I was there a few weeks ago, there was a flyer being handed out inviting people to a conference during the intermediate days of Passover in another section of Jerusalem, Silwan, which is actually a city of about 40,000, I'm told, which has the same issue, and this has been going back to the 80s, but Israelis have not always been welcome. There are a lot of different factions in the town and so on. However, I think because of the ongoing efforts of the solidarity group working in Sheikh Jarrah, trust is being built, and so this is, seems to be happening. And just the other day, I saw that Israelis are being invited for the first time in at least 20 years to participate in demonstrations in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Ras Al Amud. So things are moving along on that front as well. Most exciting to me, though, is the issue of non-cooperation. Nothing was happening, as I said, when I did the interviews, but just a few months later, in May of 2010, writer and longtime activist Ilana Hammerman smuggled three young Palestinian women and their children, young children, into Israel and took them to the beach. And this is something that a lot of humanitarian-minded Israelis do, but they do it on the quiet. They want their Palestinian friends and acquaintances to have a more normal life, and so they sneak them in. They're not. This is against the law, because Palestinians aren't allowed into Israel without a permit. And what Ilana did was that she did it openly, and she wrote about it, signed her name and so on, and has been called for questioning. I don't believe she's been tried, but she is liable for prosecution. And rather than scaring people off, 2 months later, 11 more Jewish Israeli disobedient women joined her in a drive to Tel Aviv Beach with another dozen women, baby girl, and so on, signed their names. And in August, 600 disobedient Israelis signed a petition vowing civil disobedience in an attempt to overturn, quote, this immoral law that gives rights to Jews to move freely around while keeping Palestinians imprisoned in their towns and villages, unquote. And just in March, just a couple of months ago, an International Women's Day conference was held in the West Bank village of Beit Umar. It was attended by at least 250 women, at least 100 of whom were Israeli. And they were strategizing further forms of civil disobedience. Now, for the Israeli women, just going to Beit Omar is civil disobedience, because for whatever reason, this large village, but it's a village, not a major city, is considered to be Area A. So that makes it against the Israeli law for Israelis to go there. And the kinds of civil disobedience they discussed were things like language classes in each other's territory, or bringing groups of Israeli children to the summer camp in Beit Omar and groups of children from Beit Omar into Israel. And a lot of these women were not activists prior to this, on both sides. Ilana Hammerman is quoted at that conference as saying the law regulating entry into Israel is illegal and should not be obeyed. And Sarah Benigna of the Sheikh Jarrah Solidarity Movement said, joint nonviolent activity by Palestinians and Israelis against the occupation is presently conceived as the most intimidating threat to the Israeli regime. So, and these and other developments, some quite exciting in the unfolding BDS campaign and more generally in nonviolent resistance and non-cooperation, can be followed on a number of websites on the sheets I handed out, as well as elsewhere. So this leaves me wondering and hoping, have Israeli Jews with a conscience finally begun to make a clean break with broader Israeli society, as Jonathan Kutab proposed back in 2007? Could this be the beginning of the end of what prominent BDS activist Omar Barghouti calls the multi-tiered Israeli system of oppression, whose downfall he predicts will follow the massive withdrawal of support for Israeli apartheid and occupation? And could this indeed be the beginning of the, quote, movement of Israeli nonviolent action inside Israel, with a growing component of multiple forms of non-cooperation to complement and reinforce the nonviolent joint struggle in the occupied territories, paving the way for a just, viable, and enduring peace in the region? An Israeli spring to reinforce the building Palestinian nonviolent revolution? So I leave you with that hope and question.